During World War II, soldiers used Benzedrine tablets to combat fatigue, heighten endurance, and elevate their mood. After the war, amphetamines became particularly popular with long-distance truck drivers, students studying for exams, and people trying to lose weight. A simple complaint about anxiety, excessive tiredness, or obesity to a GP usually resulted in a prescription. The short-acting tablets created effects that lasted for 4 hours. The long-acting capsules worked for up to 12 hours. Although the drugs seemed to produce energy out of nothing, it in fact created a fast track to the body's natural stores by overstimulating the central nervous system. It initiated an emotional roller coaster ride that began with sudden elation and a rise of confidence, progressed through a period of euphoria, and then ended with restlessness followed by fatigue. The choice then was whether to fall into a deep sleep that could last for as long as 17 hours or take another pill and repeat the cycle. Gordon Terry, a fiddle player then working with Farron Young, gave Cash his first tablet. They had just finished a show in Miami and had 340 miles to cover before the next day's date in Jacksonville. That night, Terry was driving Young's limousine just ahead of Luther Perkins, who was driving Cash's car. In the early hours of the morning, both vehicles pulled over to take a break, and Terry walked over to Luther and offered him a small white pill that he said would keep him awake and alert for the rest of the journey. Cash asked if they were dangerous. Terry told him that he had never suffered any side effects, a view shared with the medical community at the time. One country singer received his supply from his father-in-law, a leading surgeon in California who believed that amphetamine was a wonder drug. Merle Kilgore remembers a Nashville doctor who would visit clubs in Printer's Alley and reward musicians whose performances had drawn particularly rapturous applause by thrusting a prescription for Obedrin in their hands. Cash swallowed a pill and settled back in the car. Within half an hour, his fatigue had given way to wide-eyed verbosity, and when they arrived in Jacksonville, he was in no mood to take his customary nap. The next night, he found Terry and got another pill to help him through the show, and he eventually came down the night after that. While he felt exhausted, Cash nevertheless believed that he had discovered something that could only enhance his career. "I thought God had sent them to help me," he later admitted. By nature a shy, reflective man who hated small talk and the false bonhomie of show business parties, Cash suddenly found himself becoming garrulous and entertaining in company. Amphetamines sped up his thoughts, and he found himself making bizarre mental associations that even affected his performances. Gone were the pre-show nerves, replaced by a stage presence that emitted an almost superhuman power. His previously halting delivery of lines between songs eased into a smooth patter. He began his habit of sometimes picking his strings high up on the neck and slinging the guitar over his shoulder like a gorilla's rifle when not playing. There was an electricity in his performance that mesmerized audiences. Marshall Grant, who usually chewed gum on stage, bobbed up and down as he slapped his bass, and Luther Perkins stood bolted to the spot, looking nervously to his right as if in need of approval for every note he played. Though he was not breaking any laws, and at that time had no reason to believe he was sustaining long-term damage, Cash kept his amphetamine consumption private. Vivian didn't know to blame the drug for the long nights he spent in the den alone rather than in bed with her. Sam Phillips didn't detect any change in Cash's behavior during his recording sessions at Sun. But Marshall Grant, who didn't smoke or drink alcohol, was well aware that something was amiss. Cash's timekeeping became erratic. His conversation often veered suddenly toward the surreal. His vocals suffered, and his weight dropped, leaving him looking permanently drawn. "By the later part of 1957, I knew that something was wrong," says Marshall. "I didn't know what it was. I didn't know anything about drugs. It was bad and getting even worse, and one night we were backstage and I was looking for him to go on when I went through the door into his dressing room and found him with his head tipped back and a handful of pills. He dropped one and it rolled across the floor. That's when I knew that it was drugs." Despite the dried-up mucous membranes, occasional concert cancellation, or lapse into incoherence, the going up, as Kris Kristofferson would later put it, seemed worth the coming down during the first 2 years of Cash's amphetamine affair. Lying in the back of the car with his notebook or prowling the corridors, guitar in hand, before showtime he was getting ideas for more and more original material. He wrote "Give My Love to Rose," about an escaped prisoner's last wishes for his family, after meeting a former San Quentin inmate who asked him to pass on a message to his wife the next time he was in Shreveport. In a dressing room in White Plains, New York, after reading a story about himself titled Johnny Cash has the Big River Blues in his voice. He had the idea for Big River, which tells the tale of someone pursuing a woman down the length of the Mississippi. Although the songs contain the familiar themes of loss and longing that permeated Cash's country music and the blues, Cash's simple, direct delivery often disguised a poetic depth. He had an ability to effortlessly incorporate assonance, alliteration, and internal rhymes without drawing attention to his technique. He also had no problem incorporating his ideas into an overarching metaphor rather than settling for the plain description of emotion. Lines such as, "I taught the weeping willow how to cry, and I showed the clouds how to cover up a clear blue sky." Big River showed a lyrical richness that preceded folk rock by at least 8 years. Indeed, his songs contributed indirectly to the folk rock movement. Bob Dylan heard Cash's songs on his radio in Hibbing, Minnesota, as a high school teenager, and they became his early inspiration. He loved the primal imagery of Big River, later describing it as words turned into bone. In 2002, when asked to contribute a track to the Johnny Cash tribute album Kindred Spirits, Dylan chose Train of Love, saying by way of introduction, "I used to sing this song before I ever wrote a song." Though Sam Phillips produced Big River, Train of Love, and Give My Love to Rose, Cash felt that Phillips had lost interest in him and wanted to concentrate on his latest discovery, Jerry Lee Lewis, who had had hits with High School Confidential, Whole Lot of Shaking Going On, and Great Balls of Fire. When Phillips' newly hired trainee engineer Jack Clement took over the April 1957 session to record Next in Line and Don't Make Me Go, Cash knew for sure. His comment on the listless Next in Line, made in a letter to Ted Freeman, summed up his feeling about the new direction. "I don't particularly care for it," he said, "but it's getting good radio play." Jack Clement was a local boy who had done a 4-year stint in the Army before his discharge in 1952. He played music in the evenings and on weekends, taught dance for 6 months, spent 2 years at Memphis State University thinking he might become a journalist, and then started work with a building supply firm. As a sideline, he produced demo tapes in a friend's garage. When he took one of these tapes to Sam Phillips in June 1956 to have it mastered, the producer offered him a job. At that time, the label employed only 3 other people, an office manager, a secretary, and an engineer from a radio station also owned by Phillips.